Let's do it.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show.
Monday through
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Is this thing on? 1, 2, mic check, 1, 2. All right. What up, boy? What up, yeah?
What you know about Ray Meyer, the mad scientist of basketball who saw this clumsy 7-footer and taught him footwork and agility and touch around the basket and how to stand tall on the court, developing this George Mikan fella into a basketball pioneer?
What you know about
jumping Jim Pollard from Oakland, who was touching up top of backboards in the 40s?
What you know about
the clutchness of Sam Jones, the rebellious creativity of Red Auerbach, how Bill Russell organized a camp in Mississippi to help race relations after Medgar Evers was murdered?
What you know about
the origins of the Showtime Lakers being a nightclub in Santa Monica called The Horn? Or how Paul Westhead almost killed the dynasty before it got started?
What you know about
Chuck Daly? About number 8 Kobe? About the Silicon Valley influence on the NBA? In my new book, Dynasties, the 10 GOAT teams that changed the NBA forever, we take a look at the NBA's grand history through the lens of its dominant teams and dominant players. How not only each dynasty was built on the previous one, but how these legendary basketball teams even impacted society almost as much as the game. With popping illustrations from Yu Ming Kwan, Dynasties is a gorgeous addition to your bookshelf or your coffee table.
It is the perfect collector's item,
both for NBA fans who want to journey through history and casual fans who want to learn more about this league they can't get enough of. Get your copy of Dynasties today at Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, Target, Walmart, or wherever you buy books.
What you know about
Dynasties, the 10 GOAT teams that changed the NBA forever, wherever you buy books.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show.
And it's another hoops-adjacent episode of the Athletic NBA Show. David Aldridge here in D.C., out in the Bay. Marcus Thompson wearing a hat that I must have now. Marcus, I need to know how to get this hat that you're wearing.
Artofhomage.com. Artofhomage.com. It's my spot, man. I don't need any more fame. I am already well-known.
There you can see that.
Knows all. You feel me?
There you go. I like it. I'm going to buy a couple of these things. We got a great guest this week. He's going to be joining us. In fact, he can join us right now. Senior writer for Sports Illustrated, author of the upcoming book, Blood in the Garden.
You got to say that a certain way. Blood in the Garden.
You need the guy that used to go in a world. You know, that guy from
right?
The movies.
Exactly. Yeah.
You need that guy to say blood in the garden. Chris Herring joins us. Chris, thank you for coming in, man.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you. It's always great to be with you.
Man, I don't know. The book is out in January of next year, so we can't really talk too much about it. But trust me, you're going to want to buy this book. It is outstanding reporting, outstanding reading. It's a great flow of the Riley years in particular. Some Van Gundy in there also. But it's just, you know, as someone who was in the garden a lot back in the early 90s when those teams were – really competing against the Bulls for championships and got to the finals. It's a great read. It's a great read. So I highly recommend pre-ordering and ordering it. It would make a great holiday gift, I think. Pre-holiday gift if you can pre-order, or after New Year's if you've got people in your life that have New Year's birthdays, or after the first, get up on that thing and order Blood in the Garden.
Yo, DA, I got the advanced copy.
So did I.
let me tell you, yo, this thing is wild. The only thing
it's
I
crazy,
kept thinking, the only thing I kept thinking while I read it is like, yo, why is this the first book on this team? This team was wild. You know what I'm saying, Chris? They were crazy. Like, I can't believe this is like you're breaking the mold here of like this team needs a reality show.
Well, thank you guys. First of all, so much for even cracking the thing open. You guys know how much I admire your all's work and have for years. And I don't know the answer to that. Why they hadn't been. I mean, I think the obvious one is just I won't say for every tweet that I get that's extremely positive, people saying that they've already pre-ordered or want to. You get the, you know, asshole every now and then that's like, oh, you know, how are they getting more books written on them than titles that they won? And it's like, okay, but okay, how many books have we had on the Jordan years? How many hours of, you know, The Last Dance did we all watch individually? There's only so much after a while that you can really say about the teams that do win that generally get all of the attention. But so much of what Jordan was kind of, he became that because of who he had to get through and who he had to play. And so I guess my argument, obviously it's a biased argument, but my argument would be that you can't fully encapsulate the 90s just through Jordan. It's also who they played and, quite frankly, who in some ways, you know, the Knicks had a role in shaping that era because they continued on what the Pistons were doing through their physicality. The league immediately sought to change the rules as it related to physicality. The flagrant points in those rules and suspensions came into play because of those Knicks. When they started, you know, making tapes for Rod Thorne and everybody else to show to different teams about what would be outlawed immediately after that 94 finals where there was no scoring between the Knicks and the Rockets. They were showing clips repeatedly of Derek Harper hand-checking guys. They moved the three-point line in about 2 feet, which, you know, it seems like that would be something that is an offensive advantage, and it is, but it's also to make it so that teams like the Knicks can't just station all their big men at the rim, is to make them come out a little bit further to defend, to not just give up an open 20-foot shot that's a three. All the rules they implemented because of the fighting, which the Knicks had two or three major ones that kind of changed the course of the league against the Suns with Greg Anthony sucker punching Kevin Johnson, and also the Derek Harper JoJo English fight, which happened mere feet away from David Stern when he was with his wife.
And that's why that's why the league changed the rules, because the fight happened right in front of David Stern.
Exactly.
Nobody
disputes that. So, you know, all that stuff, and that's before you even get to like who was on that team with Mason and Oakley, and Starks was wild, and Riley would have been the wildest of all of them. I'd give the edge to Mason, but I mean, it was just a team full of characters in the biggest market in the country at a time where, you know, they had not been very good before Riley got there, and then they had a 10-year run that I think most teams would gladly take to have a shot at winning two titles, to be very close to winning another one or two, you know, as far as how competitive they were and, you know, things bounce a different way. So, yeah, those teams in some cases deserve to have something written about them because there are so many great stories just sitting there.
In some cases, they just deserve it. Like, I mean, whoever says that clearly don't watch like Marvel or DC, like, the villains are the story too, right? Like that, you got to kind of know that history and how they came to be. You can't tell without the Knicks.
Thanos was wild.
You can't tell the story of the Bulls without the Knicks, man. You just can't do it. Can't do it.
Y'all know. Y'all know because y'all have been there and been around it. And, you know, I just appreciate you guys so much for giving me an opportunity to even talk a little bit about it. Thank you.
Dude, again, I'm glad that somebody is telling people how great the league was back then, because they just look at box scores and go, oh, 82-79 couldn't have been fun. Yeah, it was hella fun. It was ridiculous fun. And as we call it, block, strip, block, block, is the shorthand for people who were in the garden that night. The Bulls just would, they could have been there for an hour and Charles Smith just would not have scored. He's just not going to score. Could have been there another 55 minutes with him just catching it and going back up. They weren't going to let him score. And that's just the bottom line. It wasn't going to happen. And that's one of the most memorable sequences that I've ever witnessed firsthand. You know, the intensity of that moment is seared into my memory because
you're not alone.
Nobody could believe it. Nobody could believe it as they saw it happening that he got stoned four times in a matter of like 9 seconds. That's just, at some point, great players either score or they get fouled. I mean, that's just how the league is, you know.
So are we concluding that Charles Smith wasn't a great player? I think
you can make that judgment. But it was one of
the biggest surprises I had in this book is, like, you know, I had a pretty clear sense of who I was going to write full chapters about. I didn't think Charles Smith was going to be one of those people. And I think he's chapter 6 in the book.
Yes.
I had so much material on him, on all the moments that led up to that. I mean, you guys have it and other people get a chance to read it. There's a whole chapter on him from like literally the first day of practice with Riley, that Riley knew he essentially didn't want him. Yeah. And just kind of like an ugly duckling. Doc Rivers kept describing him that way, of like this black swan that everybody else was the chapter that I have about Charles Smith is called The Butterfly Among the Buffaloes. Ed Tapscott, a guy from that area, from DC area.
Sure.
Great dude, by the way, and might have been the guy that provided me the best stories in the whole book. He had this quote about him where he's like, you know, every now and then you need a butterfly, you know, among your set of buffaloes. And, you know, he was like, I don't think Riley quite picked up on like how valuable he could have been for us. But literally from the first day of practice, like Charles Smith showed a certain weakness that Riley just couldn't really get his arms around. And he literally was kind of approaching people in practice saying like, I don't know that he fits. And it was, you know, they'd made this big trade to get him. They traded Mark Jackson away and to get him and Doc. And from the first day he was there, and not only that, but, you know, Riley during the season was like, I don't know if we want to lay out the money to keep this guy. And not only did the Knicks do that, that offseason, literally the day after game five, they reached a preliminary agreement on a 7-year deal to keep Charles Smith. And when you talk about the stuff that really fumbled up that process, that was one of them, you know, but Riley also was just really relentless with Charles Smith. But like I said, there's a whole lot on that in the book, which I didn't expect to get into, but I didn't realize how deep it was, of just how much I think it ruins Charles, how much I think it really kind of thwarted their ability to win the whole thing. And the lack of confidence that he had after a certain point because of what had happened with Riley. But it was literally like a day one thing where it just went off the rails immediately from the first time he got there.
Yeah, no, I was covering the Big East when Charles was at Pitt. So seeing him at Jerome Lane, who was considered a prospect, but Charles Smith was the star of those Pitt teams. And, you know, a very skilled player, you know, like would have been a classic stretch four today, would have made, you know, 6-9 figures easily because he could do everything. So it's fascinating. And again, the book's coming out in January, or pre-order it now and get it going. Because it's a great read. I want to talk to you and to Marcus about, and this is why it's called Hoops Adjacent, because we talk about other stuff, but Marcus, in your backyard, I have rarely seen an implosion. Used to be in your backyard, I should say. Rarely.
Now it's like catty corner at the house catty corner.
Dude, this Gruden thing is just, somebody asked me today, like, what's the motivation for these emails getting leaked? And I had to say what reporters never say, which is, I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not sure why these emails are being leaked, but they're being leaked. And your boy Gruden just, oh my God. I don't know who looks worse, him or Mark Davis. And you wrote a great column in The Athletic today. What do you think?
Definitely Gruden looks worse because he actually spewed the nonsense, right?
Right.
You know, It's unbelievable. I just can't get past the fact that he was literally sending emails to a team account. Like forget the dirt. Like, what he said was foul, wholly unacceptable, inhumane, and just wrong. Mm. All right, we got that. Why are you putting it on wax? Like, won't you make a song I don't even understand. It's insane to me that, and it shows and look, keep in mind, people got to understand, John Gruden was a superstar. Superstar.
Won a Super Bowl.
Yeah, won a Super Bowl. He was, even more than a football coach, he was a celebrity. In the early 2000s, you know, they were calling him Chucky, and he was like the child's play. He was famous for the grimace on the sideline. He was young then, you know, so it had a little appeal.
Wake up at 3:17 every morning.
Yep, he was Mr. Growl in football, and you know, he was that guy, right? And he brought the Raiders back to prominence. You know, then he leaves, goes to Tampa, beats him in the Super Bowl, and he's this celebrity figure, ends up on TV, he's a celebrity. So clearly, this dude got comfortable, right? Yes. His feet is up on the couch of life, right? And he's just talking crazy. Right. And it's unbelievable to me, to the point where we all know when we talking crazy and we don't want nobody else to see this.
right? It may not be that level of stuff, but we might just be talking about people, right? Yes. Yes. Talking about somebody else's in-laws or whatever, right? You just know when you're doing it that right. there's a certain, like, all right, I need to protect myself from this getting out. He had no barriers up. He was just like, hey, homie, Bruce Allen. Yeah, he's another one who looks bad in this. Because there was no reports of his emails rejecting that nonsense, right?
No,
but he's like, yo, he's literally ripping the commissioner, calling him slurs on an NFL account. Like, I mean, you can't, this is the height of arrogance. And it's crazy. I just can't get my mind past that.
It's like, I'm going to write this, you know, because it involves Washington, the Washington football team, which is in my backyard. He's a made guy. These are the actions of a made guy in the mob.
That's funny because I watch The Sopranos.
You can't touch me. Thanks. Whatever I do, you can't touch me. I'm a made guy. You know, and the fact that he was talking not only to Bruce Allen, this is the part that just is incongruous to me, but you know, owners of other companies who I'm sure did deals with NFL teams, if not the NFL itself, you know. And like you said, the comfort level, just like there's no breaks on this. There's no, hey, don't repeat this, but no, there's just
like he's in a sauna at 24-hour fitness or something, like, you know, like he's at the strip club, like, like whatever we say, stay here. Like, bro, just email.
So there's a trail. Like, you're on the grid, like my man used to say. You're on the grid.
He felt secure, though. He felt secure. Here's the part that I'm gonna admit bothers me a little bit. Chris, maybe you could weigh in on this. So he said some racist stuff. It was cool.
Right. Exactly. It's bad, but.
You'll be all right. I'm sorry. I'm not having the oppression Olympics here.
The blade of racism was holding up.
Hey,
it was holding up.
Hey, he just came like, you know what? My bad. I ain't mean it that way. And was like, we all good, right? We all good. We chilling. I'll be all right. I just didn't like that. How he just it just kind of moved on. I mean, that was pretty. That was foul what he said about Demoris, right?
Yes.
Like that.
Yes,
that's incredibly foul. And. Yes. We moved on kind of quick from that, bro. I got a problem with that.
Yep. And you know what? I've said this before. I think one of the things that bothers me most about social media is like how quick people are to essentially, first of all, I don't even know if he apologized or if he did, how he went about apologizing. Dude. I was like,
yeah, it was one of those, like whatever sorry if I offended anybody, non-apologies.
Right. And so like you get so many people that like, will accept an apology on another group of people's behalf. So it's like, you know, when someone does some like really foul stuff with regards to, you know, for instance, like the, you know, sexual harassment stuff, like it's not really on men to accept that apology from a man who's like a superior to everybody with all these women that he's working with. It's not for us to do that. Just like it's not really for white people to say how offended they are or are not by what he said about Demoris Smith, like, which is about as racist as it gets. Like, that's like OG racism. Like, right. When you talk about right? what his stuff was, I mean, like, that's like,
that's Amos old, and Andy. Like, that's to like, where
it's going back to like before our time, really. So, I mean, like, that it's crazy because some people are like, oh, that's not really that bad. It's like, it might not be that bad to you because you might not even recognize it as so old. Right,
exactly.
And so for him to say that it's not, oh, well, it wasn't intended in a racist manner. Well, doggone, like you really hit the racism nail on the head as far as like figuring out what it's like pinning the tail on the donkey with a blindfold on the first try.
Right.
Like that was how accurate that was. So there were a lot of people saying like it wasn't that bad or they didn't understand it. It didn't help. And I get that this is not really their cross to bear, but like you had Mike Tirico and you had Tony Dungy kind of saying like, that's not the guy I know.
Right.
And then a day later you have this. It's not a good look.
No.
It's not a
so
good
I will look, say yeah. that people moved on from it quickly. But I think people are willing to kind of essentially say, oh, he probably didn't mean it that way. Or like, he's not that bad a dude because my interactions, like you can write that off
for a lot of people feel like you can just write that off if it's just that. Mm-hmm. But then it was everything else. I do think that honestly, you know, the order of it in which it happened, if one of these things had happened maybe a day before and then the issue with Demora Smith had been included in all this, that would have been enough to do it too. So I do think it just kind of happened that way. Mm-hmm. But it did kind of feel like with what you guys are saying, like who leaked this? Because it was kind of like one song to try to get somebody off stage. And then I was like, oh, that wasn't enough. Let me play the other hits for you.
Like my man, Mr. T said in Rocky III, I got a lot of mo. I got a lot of mo.
Right. And so there was a little bit of that vibe to it where it's like, they kind of thought that, or like when you try to blow out all the candles and like you blow out the first one, but there's still like two more. And it's like the rest of them.
And now they spit all over the cake, right? Like it's just, right.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody has an appetite to finish this cake anymore. So that's kind of what happened. Well, but it was a little frustrating to see that, in all seriousness.
The thing that I take from this is simply the, you know, like you've mentioned, this is not the fight for necessarily for white males to weigh in on, although they do. And it's okay. To me, it's fine if you want to. Half of them are bots anyway. I get that. So it's okay. But... I was talking to a friend of mine this morning, and it was like, see, this is the problem. White people tend not to believe black people when they say, no, this is what really happens to us every day. Men tend not to believe women when women say, no, this is what happens to us every day, you know? And so this is like the Olympics of, you know, just misogyny and racism. Anti-gay slurs, just like, come on. And people go, no, people aren't like that. Yeah, people are like
absolutely.
People are like this in positions of power, and we tell you this and you don't believe us. You know, and then, like we're and then not making become, it up.
They become lone wolves, right? Like yeah. Somehow he's the rare breed. Like, nah, he felt comfortable.
Very
for
comfortable.
A reason. So my thing, when I wrote about this, I was like, dude, like y'all light this flame every week for Al Davis. And this ain't how Al Davis wrote, right?
No.
is not how Al Davis, this ain't what he was about. And the irony of John Gruden coming to the Raiders supposedly to revive like the Raiders, right? He's supposed to bring them back to former glory. Missed the biggest one of them all. Like, you got Art Shell, Tom Flores, Amy Trask, right? Like,
right.
Jim Plunkett, right. Gene Upshaw, like John Madden, right. Like
right.
This is like
George Atkinson. Yeah, Lester
George
Hayes,
Atkinson, right?
Jack Tatum back in the day.
Al Davis is like, look, man, I don't care what you look like, where you from.
Right.
If you down a ride, let's go. Like, if you work hard, you got some talent, rock with us, right?
Right,
and if you go to a Raider game, the tailgates is like that. That's what it's like. It's East Oakland. It's the hills. It's Mexicans. It's blacks. It's white. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Everybody's kicking it. And there's like that. That is the great thing about the Raiders. That's part of it. And for them, for John Gruden to miss that so badly and never really kind of own it, never really kind of adopt that part of it. And for Mark Davis to be so hungry to get him back that he ain't even pay attention. Like, I'm not buying the fact that he couldn't find this to a few emails. Right.
Well, I was talking to Chris beforehand. What was the vet exactly on John Gruden? Like, how did you?
It was, do you want to come
did
here?
They look at.
No, I got $100 million. Yes. That's how it went.
It's crazy.
Pretty much.
Man.
I mean, I don't even want to get into a conversation about, like, so can we talk about the Rooney Rule now and, like, how people that said it wasn't necessary.
Right.
That this is what you get sometimes when you don't bet candidates and when you're just going to throw $100 million at them for 10 years.
Right.
Like, that's the wild part to me, that all this could just be out there. And look, I'm just going to say it as someone that used to work there. I imagine, like, ESPN's a pretty big place. Like, you rub shoulders with a lot of people.
Sure.
You're sending emails that freely to folks, just to whoever. You know, maybe they're not caught immediately. Maybe not everybody sees him. Somebody knew how this dude was. And I imagine that he, like you said, he probably didn't confine his behavior just to emails. I'm sure he slipped and said things to other people. Keyshawn Johnson's been trying to tell us all about this dude for the longest.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the book is out there on this dude to at least some people. And if you truly want to know that, and you know, I agree with what Marcus is saying, that I imagine somebody had to know. Like, I mean, you don't. Background checks are done on other people for a lot less than giving out $100 million to them.
Right.
So, I mean, it's frustrating from that standpoint. You know, yes, there was a good off season as it relates. I don't know how the NFL did. I know there was at least one or two candidates of color that got jobs. You know, I know the NBA had a good off season for that, but
right.
it's frustrating when, you know, people ask, oh, well, how do you know that it's just race and that it's not just the best candidate? It's like, okay, you can have John Gruden if you want him, but you're going to have this laundry list of problems and then have to fire him regardless of what his record was. Yeah. So.
And that's the
issue. If you can find Eric Bieniemy emails to Bruce Allen to talk this way, then no, you shouldn't hire Eric Bieniemy either. You know,
exactly.
You know what I mean? But I don't think they exist. You know what I'm saying?
So. And this issue with football, you can it's kind of this culture that almost like celebrates the ability to kind of wall off all that other stuff, right? Like, I just focus on football, and I don't know about this other stuff. And there's a relative glory in that you are so consumed with football that you don't have to think about these things. You don't have to necessarily progress mentally, right? These dudes are rich, right? They've been around all kind of people. Like, there's no greater life lesson probably than an NFL locker room. And they don't learn anything, right? They don't grow at all, which is but that's the ethos. So I could totally see them saying, well, this dude's 1,000% about football, and we know he's probably going to stick to that because that's our culture, just football. Right. We don't got to talk about it. The previous guy, what's his name? Jack Del Rio would be watching Fox News. But, you know, you kind of – it's like, yo, this is about football. It's not about all that politics stuff. But when you do that – this is what happens, right? You know, you ask questions about it, you know. So at minimum, they at least get dinged for acting like that stuff doesn't matter. And that's the major problem. It has always mattered with the Raiders. Always mattered. They're the team like, yo, if you got a domestic violence, we ain't fooling with you. Like, that's not how we roll. You know, they got Biletnikoff. You know, they support him championing the cause. Like, the Raiders have been about, man, who are you? What you about?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, so to blindly turn that off to get a guy to come run spider Y banana, whatever, right? Like that is as much of a mistake as not vetting, right? Like to me, like but you get that a lot in NFL where they just like,
hey, I know.
We focus on football. Focus on football.
It's crazy. So
discover the latest collections from David Yurman, as seen recently, styled on basketball stars like Jaime Jaquez, Jalen Green, D'Angelo Russell, and others. David Yurman is a celebrated American jewelry company inspired by the beauty of art, architecture, and the natural world. The story of David Yurman begins in New York City, with David, a sculptor, and his wife Sybil, a painter and ceramicist. When the artists began collaborating, their goal was to simply make beautiful designed objects to wear. Over 40 years later, the Yurmans and their son, Evan, continue to redefine American luxury jewelry with timeless, modern collections for women and men defined by inspiration, innovation, consummate craftsmanship, and Cable, the brand's artistic signature. David Yurman's collections are available on davidyurman.com.
So there's no good way to transition off of this, but we have to because we do.
Well, the Raiders wear black, and then the Nets wear black. So about Kyrie. Oh,
there you go. That's the worst transition ever.
Right? That was awful.
You've got to work on that. Yeah. It's 2 weeks now that there was just a terrible transition.
Hey, I didn't even have to come to that conclusion. Like the squirmish on Chris's face told me all I needed to know. Like, what?
Man. All right. So look, this, this is something. This is very interesting to me. I'm going to say this. And I've written it, and so it's not a surprise. It shouldn't come as any surprise to anybody. Kyrie Irving has every right to do whatever he wants to do with his life. He does. He has every right to not get vaccinated. He has every right to hold out and say that's personal and private, and I'm not going to talk about it, and I'm not going to play the home games. I'll try to play the road. And the Brooklyn Nets have every right to say, you're not playing for us until you do. That's the bottom line. That's how this thing works. That's how this country works. private citizen can make whatever decision they want to make about their lives, but private companies have the right to do the same thing. All of you Hobby Lobby people who are all about Hobby Lobby can do whatever they want. It's a private company. You need to have the same energy to say the Brooklyn Nets have the right to do what they want to do with their private company. And I don't get that because I've been getting a lot of, mostly bots, I'm sure, but a lot of pushback on all I tweeted this morning was from the Nets. I didn't make no judgments about it. I didn't say, good move, Nets.
Ain't that the easiest tale where you just say
from
the fact
the Nets.
And people lose their mind? That's like the tale, right?
And people
there.
Went nuts.
Like Twitter. Steph Curry had 20 points. Oh, he's overrated. Like, dude, I just gave you a stat.
Stating a fact. That's all I'm doing. Look, Chris, you're an NBA guy. We're all NBA guys here. Tell me what you think. What do the Nets do? How do they handle this going forward?
Well, it's interesting because, I just had a conversation about this on our podcast at Sports Illustrated on Open Floor. My coworker, my partner, Michael Pina, asked me that question, like, could you see that happening? And I was like, and also after Nash had just said, we're prepared for him to only play half the games, which he kind of opened that door, which it was surprising because we're like, oh, y'all are good with that? Y'all are just going to ride with
right,
that?
Right, right, right.
So that was just yesterday. So this has been moving quickly. My response to it yesterday was, could I see them doing that? Yes, if they have the blessing from KD and Harden. If they don't, which it's not to say they have to, but if they don't, it gets really awkward from that standpoint because are they playing angry? Are they upset? Are they cool with Kyrie only having to play half the time? And oh, by the way, like he's essentially paid the same to do that, and obviously how much are you docking his pay and stuff like that? Is a separate question, but look, if you were just a middle of the road team, whatever, you're a team that's like expected to win the whole thing potentially.
Yeah.
And to some extent, maybe you still have a shot to do that without him, maybe as a part-time guy, but this isn't baseball. You're not a designated hitter. Right. So it's different from that standpoint. So, from my standpoint, what I really want to hear and know now is like, how do Durant and Harden feel about this? Particularly Harden, who has pretty openly used this as like, this is my last year here as far as being under contract, and I'll figure everything else out later.
Yeah.
Maybe he doesn't care. I imagine that KD is tighter with Kyrie than Harden is. Obviously, they signed there together. I don't know that anybody can really blame the Nets. Like you said, I think most people would look at it logically and say, sure, Kyrie can make whatever decision he wants, but the Nets have a right to do what they need to do. If only to try to win a championship, which they may be of the opinion that it's not possible or a lot less feasible that they do it with the part-time player who, by the way, even if it's not the vaccine, it could be any other number of things where Kyrie just takes time off.
Yeah.
And it makes him a liability from that standpoint too. Not to mention that he hasn't always been the most durable player anyway. So I get it. I totally get it. I'm a little surprised that they took that step. But it sounds like they did at least talk to Harden and KD. I don't know if they were in lockstep with them. Their statement kind of made it look like they might not have been.
Right.
That it was Marks and him and the owner.
Yeah.
And so if they made the decision and kind of went against whatever KD and Harden were saying, then that becomes even more interesting. But look, I do think it is a little bit kind of not tenable to have a season where it's just kind of on again, off again. What do you do if and when you make the playoffs and you have a series against the Knicks? What are you supposed to do?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, like, you're going to have a whole series where he doesn't
sit. A series against anybody.
That too. I mean, you would almost rather not have home court advantage.
Right.
Like, based on that, which doesn't make sense.
No.
So it's a weird, everything about it is weird. But look, if you can go get relatively, equal talent back for him in the form of a couple pieces, you have two of the 10 best players in the league.
Yeah.
I think most people would say at full strength, Kyrie is the worst of those three anyway. So, it's a huge piece to be giving up, but if you can get something back for him, you might be better off with the depth anyway. Maybe that's a stretch to say, but it might not be if the other two guys can stay healthy.
I mean, it is a fascinating, it is a interesting question. If you were to trade him to a non-New York team, a non-Golden State team, obviously, right? A team that does not have the rules in place, the city right. rules in place about vaccinations, does that make him a more tradable commodity? I don't know. I mean, that's another thing that I can't say that I know right now, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's been an interesting couple of years for this man. You know, I wrote a column about him last week, and I think the headline on the column was, no, getting the vaccine is not merely a personal choice, because obviously, if nothing else, you know, regardless of what people want to say about personal choice, and this is not my foremost concern as someone that that thinks everybody should get vaccinated. If, you know, I could hold out some, you know, feelings for the religious part of it for certain people. But other than that, you know, that thinks that everybody should get vaccinated, your team having to wonder whether you can play for 40 some games when you're a contender, that's makes it a team situation at a minimum, outside of just societally how it should play out. You know, I spent hours just trying to research all the good that Kyrie had done for different groups of people as it relates to the WNBA, as it relates to Native Americans in this country, as it relates to, you know, George Floyd's family, as it relates to all sorts of people that this man has given money to, that he's made, you know, quite frankly, love him or hate him, and a lot of people really don't like him. His comments were somewhat prescient. I don't know that he viewed it from this standpoint, so I think I'd be giving him too much credit to say that he said to sit out the bubble because of something.
Right.
He did say, you know, when the bubble played out the way it did, and when you had George Hill, I thought it was very interesting that George Hill basically said after the Jacob Blake situation, we shouldn't have never came out here.
Right.
That Kyrie had been, you know, people were upset with Kyrie because he was hurt during the bubble. And so they're like, why are you speaking up this loudly for something that you're not going to play in anyway? Mm-hmm. It's not really your call. But, you know, in hindsight, it looked, I don't know if I would say it looked smart, but, you know, his point of view, I think, was better taken at that point. He's right about stuff sometimes. He's in the right. He makes the right decisions. He is doing things that are pushing communities forward in some ways. So he's not always wrong on this stuff. I don't think he's crazy.
No.
I do think that he's misguided on a whole lot of stuff. I don't think that he needs to be the foremost voice on a lot of these issues. But this one, it just feels like he's very wrong on. And I don't know how teams will accept, you know, different things. I had a whole conversation yesterday. If you could trade Kyrie for Simmons, it makes, at this point, a lot of sense for both teams.
Yeah. Yes.
A whole lot of sense, which is a weird thing to say.
Problem for a problem. Yes.
Yeah. That's,
if Simmons is vaccinated, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Like, you could win with him. He's a durable guy, aside from when he hurt his foot.
And you won't need him to shoot at the end.
Kyrie gives him a point guard.
Right. Yeah.
You won't need him. You won't want him to shoot at the end at this point. With the way that, you know, I guess if he refuses, you don't know how he shoots, but Kyrie would give Philly a long needed position, you know, fill a long needed spot for them. You know, then you don't have to chase Dame anymore. You get Kyrie. It's a risk. It's certainly a risk having Kyrie and Embiid. Man, that's a risk on two different levels. Sure. You know, I love Embiid, but he's an injury risk. So it could theoretically work. It gets both teams
Except
out of a problem.
You're going to Brooklyn for game 7 in the Eastern Conference Finals.
Right.
Like,
that's right.
I forgot about that.
No, as a visitor, he can play.
He can play. Right.
He can play. Yeah. That's what I was about to say. He can play in those games. So that's right. So it gets you out of a big problem, you know, and it's funny. I just can't think of what equivalent trades look like aside from that. And that might not be totally equivalent.
No, but it's close.
Philly
enough.
Gets real scary.
Yeah.
Philly gets real scary at that point.
They both get really scary because Kyrie.
But Brooklyn is too.
Because what Ben Simmons could bring to Brooklyn is just, it's almost unfair. If you think about the lineups they could put out, both offensively and defensively, but more defensively.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing that's fascinating to me about Kyrie is this. This dude could have won, I'm guessing, 3 or 4 championships with LeBron James in Cleveland, minimum. And he said, and I've always said this, you can't tell Kyrie Irving that he wasn't just as important, if not more important, to them winning a title that year than as LeBron was. Because he hit the series winning shot. He hit it. He hit the 3 that gave them the lead for good in game 7. He hit that shot. You can't tell Kyrie Irving nothing. And I'm not being critical of him. I'm saying if I'm Kyrie Irving, I'm 25 years old, I just won a chip. I did that. So I can do whatever the hell I want to do. And so for a guy to walk away from LeBron James, they basically said, nah, get me out of here. I don't want to play with. I'd rather start my own thing. God bless you, but that's a lot that you have to deal. That's a lot on any franchise's plate.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23 for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
Can I?
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Can I just say I respect that about him a little bit? Like, I kind of
absolutely. Like, no, even, I'm not being critical of him at all.
Even,
but he's saying I didn't need this dude. This dude needed me as much as I needed him. You know what I'm saying?
He's always bristled. So I don't. You know, I'm not someone that brags about. I don't think I have enough of them to brag about, like, one-on-one conversations I have with these guys. But, you know, we were talking about my Nick's book earlier that's on the way. And I remember years ago thinking abstract ideas, like, what could I do something on that could potentially be a book someday? And I remember thinking, maybe I'll write something on LeBron and, like, his business stuff. And I remember I was here in Chicago, and there was a – they had the Olympic – preseason games, like the exhibition games before they went abroad for the Olympics. So this would have been 2016. Mm-hmm. And Kyrie was on the team.
Yes.
Kyrie was by himself. So I'm like, let me walk up to Kyrie and kind of ask him, not so much about LeBron, but just kind of, you know, being a teammate of his and seeing the way he moves and how much business success LeBron has had, like basically a $1 billion athlete. You know, if in some ways that serves as a model for the way that players want to move as far as kind of calling their own shots and building their own kind of business empires within, you know, the money that they make in the league. And the way this man bristled when I mentioned LeBron, is it related to like being like anything that would be like a, you know, something that players wanted to replicate. He's like, what does LeBron have to do with this? And I was just kind of like, I mean, nothing as it relates specifically to you. I'm just asking for NBA players in general, like he's kind of, I would imagine he's kind of the prototype as far as what other people want to do and want to build for themselves. And obviously Kyrie has done very well for himself. Mm-hmm. Movie.
Yeah.
His shoes are obviously very, very popular. He's very popular with kids to the point where, you know, you could argue that it was kind of corrosive for children to some extent with the flat earth thing that Kyrie said he was hearing from science teachers all over the country about how bad a message it was sending.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, but the way he bristled, and then I think he kind of came down a little bit when he realized I wasn't, you know, you're so used to the reporters. People have said, LeBron, is he like a father figure? And I get, as a black man, I understand why that would bristle at him. And so I think that's different, but it's to a point where rarely can you even mention LeBron to him in something that's even, like, construed as, like, a positive without him bristling like that. And I remember feeling it really intensely, just kind of asking him even that question. So he's always been someone that has wanted to show that he can be his own guy. Mm-hmm. It certainly felt like that when he went to Boston. And he's also kind of come down off that and said, I probably was doing a little bit too much with that. Like I did learn a lot from Bron and I was probably a little bit too high on myself. Yeah. But he said something along those lines a couple years ago. So I think he's someone between that and the flat earth thing. Whether he just completely doesn't feel that way anymore or if he just realizes I might have kind of gone too hard on this particular subject, I think he realizes it in hindsight. Mm-hmm. I'm really hopeful for that as it relates to the vaccine, but I have no clue what it will mean. I mean, at this point, he's left. This will make the third team that he's left if they decide to move on from him. And it's still premature to say that.
It is.
But all three of these teams now have been kind of like thrown into flux. When you think of it, when you really think about it, and I don't know what that says about him. I mean, I could kind of suggest what I think it says, but he can be, you know, people got upset with Woj when I think he called him the disruptor a couple years ago in that column that he wrote, or last year. It wasn't a couple years ago. I mean, he there are some elements of him that are disruptive. Good, bad, indifferent, whatever. He doesn't move the way everybody else moves, good or bad. And, you know, so it'll be interesting to see what Brooklyn does. It'll be interesting to see whether he gets the vaccine. If he doesn't, it's fascinating if he does not.
I can't help but think about, like, Kevin Durant in this in this equation.
Sure.
I mean, Kyrie, I mean, he's shown time and again, once his mind's made up, like, that dude has a stubborn will, right? Like, he can dig in, unlike most, right? And none of us would be surprised if he's like, yo, I'm not doing this and I don't care what it costs me, right? We would be surprised because he's that dug in. And like, KD left to be with him, right?
Yes.
You left Steph Curry to go play with Kyrie, right? Like, you left.
Yes.
Like, that's, and wow. there's
that's one way to put it.
I know there's some element of, you know, a point guard, the responsibility of that being to the team and to the to helping everybody else get better. And even last year, Kyrie was like, all right, James, you the point guard. You the point guard. Right. Like, I'm about to get these buckets, right? Like, it's just, I just wonder about, like, Kevin Durant and how, you know, KD might win a title without him, so it doesn't matter, right in the grand scheme. Yeah, but
I mean, look.
They could.
Look,
but that's
two of the top 10 players in the league starting on their roster every night. So come on,
yeah, right. That's
not like
grand.
They're going to be in the lottery without Kyrie. You know what I'm saying?
I just wonder how that whole dynamic. To me, that's fascinating. What? Like, if they were to write a book on it, I would read it.
Marcus, we talked about this with Steph last week, and again, I was blown away that this is a code thing. Like, I just can't see KD stepping to Kyrie like that and saying, "Yo, man, come on, what you doing? What are you doing? Like, we had a chance to get this chip." And Steph made it so clear that you can't do that on this. And whether I agree with it or not is irrelevant. That's what it is. And even at that level, at a championship contending team level, you can't step to your teammate and say, "Yo, man, you could cost us a chance of winning a ring here. What are you doing?"
But if he's already declaring, "I'm down to lose millions."
Yeah,
I mean, he's kind of already made his point clear in that vein. But, you know, the code don't stop people from feeling, right? So
that's right.
I do wonder how they feel about it, right? Like
exactly. That's what I was going to say is, like, you know, and I remember they got mad that the media made a whole lot out of it when they were in the hallway at the All-Star game, kind of messing around and everything. They clearly care for each other on a deep level. Mm-hmm. That's part of a big part of why they made the decision to play together, whether it had been there, whether it had been with the Knicks or what have you. You know, people talk about it being a brotherhood in the league, and I imagine with some people it is. That one is one where I do wonder a little bit, and I venture to guess it doesn't, but that's kind of a different level of, like, you know, the fact that KD can still potentially have conversations with certain guys. He's done the podcast with Draymond and what have you.
Yeah.
But whether or not, like, does that fundamentally, when it's so clear that you would probably be the favorite, and not just the favorite, but that y'all could potentially win a couple of these things.
The overwhelming favorite entering.
Y'all made the decision to come here together and, like, to potentially be here for years to build essentially your own thing. KD took all the shots for not, you know, for joining a ready-made situation in Oakland. So the idea that this was their thing together and now that Kyrie might just move on because he won't get the vaccination, I do wonder a little bit about that and how that changes the dynamic. Like I said, I imagine they're still tight and that, you know, KD says, "Look, man, I get that, you know, you just don't believe in it, you won't do it." But I do imagine that's different. That's interesting on a level that there's layers to it, but it's still, if you want to win as badly as I think that you want to win at that level, at a superstar level, it's kind of stunning that he won't.
Yeah.
But he is someone that when I think of who would dig in and just leave that position, it's him.
No question.
Yeah. And so I won't be surprised if he doesn't, because I could very easily.
And if there's somebody who could look his teammate, his friend in the eye and be like, "Listen, I love you. You know, I love you. mm-hmm. but I can't yeah. do this. Right. right. Like right. it's him. Right. right? Like yeah. he will do it. And, yep. and you know what? They will understand. I don't know how they feel about it, but they will right. understand what right. intrigues me about Kyrie, the person. Like, I start to wonder, like, at some point he can't do this thing alone. Right. Mm-hmm. At some point he can't just be operating yeah. in this space alone. Right. At some point he's going to need somebody. Right. Right. And I understand this urge to kind of, you know, me against the world, your life. You yeah. know what I'm saying? But like, yeah, like yeah. He needs them, man. Like he needs them. Right. And I hope he understands that. Like, forget us. I know he don't like us. We admit whatever. But them his guys. You know what yeah, I'm saying? Yeah, like yeah. them are his right? dog. And he's gone to places now where it's like, yo.
Plus, I mean, I'm not trying to be flip. He's running out of dudes. You know
that's what I'm saying?
Like, you're running like, out of impactful dudes to partner with. Like, you've gone through pretty much the whole top of the yeah, unless you want to play with Giannis, I guess. I guess you ain't said that yet. But you know, other than that, it's there ain't too many guys left that he hasn't had some affiliation with or some rumor about yet that he, you know, and so, you know, like, and they got to want to, and it's a two-way street. Them guys got to go like, oh yeah, I'll roll with Kyrie. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know yeah. what I mean? Like,
that part of it too. That's, you know, that's the important part of it too. You're right.
Yeah.
You're
so right. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. Look, we could do, I'm going to hold the stupid questions until next week. There's some good ones as we start the season next week. I'm going to hold those off because this has been too good. And there's no, as Marcus is terrible at transitions, I'm not going to try to transition to.
No. I'm actually pretty good, but that was, whoo. That, no, that was bad. No. that was bad on a level where, like, yo, yeah, that was bad. I'm sorry, Chris. Yeah. I'm sorry. My bad. I didn't mean to expose you to that level of futility.
That was one that was pretty memorable yeah. in a bad way.
So. All right, the book is Blood in the Garden. Pre-order.
Hey, can
now.
We trade Corsair. Books? By the way, can we like do a swap? I'm gonna send you mine, and then you know, like I ain't talking about that paperback.
I already have.
Hold on, you got it?
I tweeted at you the other
you
day.
You sure did.
I got it the other day. No, yeah, sure I bought one the other day.
Oh, I'm talking about a sign. I want mine signed, man. Don't be messing with me.
I got you. Right. I got you. Once I get the final, yo, I send in
black
final
authors
got
to stick together, right?
See, I agree with that.
See, the Raiders wear black, the Nets wear black, and we. Oh, no.
Is this our transition out of the podcast? My God.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for joining this terribly transitioned podcast.
Oh, my God.
Best
goodness.
Of luck with the book.
Y'all are the best. Man, I appreciate you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, everybody, leave that 5-star review of this fine American podcast on Spotify, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, wherever you hear us. And Marcus, I'm going to throw this up to you one more time so you don't mess this one up. If it's less than 5 stars, what should they do?
You better keep it to yourself or Chris Herrick going to beat you down. And it's going to be blood in a garden because you didn't give us 5 stars.
That was a pretty decent transition.
Boom, I'm back, baby. Let's go.
That was golden. That was
golden. Yeah, there we go.
Literally. Oh, outstanding. That's so good. Oh, man.